Now enter into the equation the sons of Elohim. They've been living endlessly. Before Satan's fall, after Satan's fall, when the earth was originally created good and Satan was on it before he fell, and they saw the cataclysm that struck the earth, and they saw it become a waste and desolation. They saw the universe formed. They saw the galaxies of billions formed. They'd been in God's presence part or all of that time. These are people that could build pyramids. I actually believe they came to the earth as any construction crew to build a great pyramid. Like all construction crews, they got horny. And they saw the daughters of men, daughters of Adam. And they produced these strange beings born of daughters of Adam by sons of Elohim. And they were called Redeem, heroic, and a brand of Ishi, a name of great men, not great Adams, great men. Three superior species who got increasingly evil until God wiped them out. Now, angels have form. Fallen angels have form. Mortals, men, die and have to be raised by God. These offspring of the daughters of Adam and the Nephilim, sons of Elohim, they would have a mixture. The eternal nature of the sons of Elohim and the fleshly mortal nature of the daughters of Adam. And when they're destroyed with the flood, buried in the waters, we got bodiless eternal spirits looking for vessels to inhabit, be it the boy of the Gadarenes, or until they're banished to the abyss, bottomless pit, the pigs alongside the shore of Galilee that they begged to be entered, to enter into when Jesus cast them out of the demoniac of the Gadarenes. The devil's angels and demons are not necessarily the same. That's my explanation for wandering spirits seeking bodies to inhabit. These offspring of the sons of Elohim and the daughters of Adam, whose bodies died, being the product of the daughters of Adam, and whose spirits still roam the earth, seeking bodies to inhabit. But that's a sidebar. The point I'm making, before I get into Graham Hancock's Fingerprints of the Gods, where we saw the Piri Reis map and ancient map makers who had sources in which they mapped Antarctica, now under a mile of ice, mapped rivers and mountains that now modern scientific sonar mapping proves to be accurate, but these maps were drawn when there was no ice over Antarctica. That takes us back to 12, 13, 15,000 BC, when intelligent beings were on this earth mapping. We take for granted that longitude is something that's always been around. Latitude was rather easy to figure because you could sight it in on the stars. Longitude demanded an exact timepiece, chronometer, where you could exactly figure the time it took you to leave a certain place to another place. Even minutes off could make you miss a longitudinal position in the middle of the ocean. Yet these ancient maps had the sophisticated spherical trigonometry knowledge and the chronometer that wasn't invented until the middle of the 17th century. It took 40 years to invent, with a man giving his whole time to it. These 10, 12,000 years ago, when Antarctica was not covered with ice, they had longitude down perfect. Somewhere way, way back there, superior beings. Khufu didn't. Cheops, whether you want his Egyptian or his Greek name, didn't build the Great Pyramid. The Bent Pyramid wasn't a practice pyramid. The Bent Pyramid was a practice pyramid, but people didn't know how to build the Great Pyramid, but saw it and wanted to imitate it. The rest of the pyramids are graves. The Great Pyramid was built more like 10, 12,000 years ago, and built with the knowledge of the precession of the equinoxes to tell a prophetic story that begins when the North Star was in the dragon constellation, symbolizing man under the dominion of Satan and going down. A master race was back there somewhere. And I'm telling you, Genesis 6 is proof enough. Common deductive logic tells you there were three streams of superior beings before the flood. We just need to kill the mindset of those that are thinking Bishop Usher was a scientist. No, he wasn't. Genealogy is not an adequate way to date the earth. And if you put Atlantis back 10, 12,000 years, then you can start making sense of the Bible and things in Genesis. I'll try to do it if you want me to continue. Get on the telephone. This is a nice statement. Santa Clara, no more calls, please. I'm very interested in this teaching. Very thankful to have a pastor who can translate the Word of God. I used to pray for a teacher like you. Now I can be taught by you 24 hours a day. Yeah, you can if you get a satellite dish or shortwave radio. Graham Hancock. Now, you're going to run out and empty all the bookstores of this book, Fingerprints of the Gods. You're going to make the same mistake as buying Holy Blood, Holy Grail, or a lot of other things. I think you ought to read it. But you better keep it as a textbook while I read sections of it to you. Graham Hancock has absolutely pioneered and proven the evidence of a master civilization more than 10,000 years ago. But he teaches more from a generic frame. And what's missing is linking a right translation and rendition of Scripture with the wonderful evidence that he finds. So don't try to go ahead of me in the book. Stay with me, because I'm going to cross-reference it with many others. I have Rutherford's library, which was the greatest library up to its time, of scholars on the pyramid. But I can't recommend any one book because they all, including Rutherford, get a little too caught up in their subject, and then they stop reporting and start editorializing, and they draw conclusions not merited by the facts, and then they, in essence, wipe out the value of much of the research that they do. The complete book on the pyramid is not yet published. The best is probably the hours and hours of teaching that are on tapes here, but I'm not finished with the subject by any means. Now, you'll go buy this book. You probably should. Graham Hancock's a great researcher and writes well, and he's on to something. But it's Fingerprints of the Gods that I've been reading about these ancient maps. Were other parts of the world surveyed and accurately charted at widely separated intervals during roughly from 13,000 B.C. to 4,000 B.C.? The answer may lie once again in the Piri Reis map, which contains more mysteries than just Antarctica. We taught on it one night, showed you pictures out of this book, Queen Maud Land and other sections of Antarctica, drawn with absolute accuracy, confirmed by sonar mapping now through a mile of ice, but drawn when there was no ice on Antarctica, at a time, I believe, when there was a canopy, at a time before God moved in and destroyed Atlantis and sunk it in the sea. Drawn in 1513, this map by Piri Reis demonstrates an uncanny knowledge of South America, in addition to Antarctica. Not only of its eastern coast, but of the Andes Mountains on the western side of the continent. 1513. Which were, of course, unknown at the time. The map correctly shows the Amazon River rising in these unexplored mountains and thence flowing eastwards. Itself, that is the Piri Reis map, compiled from more than 20 different source documents of varying antiquity, because he had access to the Great Library of Constantinople, that undoubtedly, because it was the capital of the Byzantine Empire, had brought copies or duplicates of some of the stuff destroyed in that terrible act of destroying the Great Library built by the Ptolemies at Alexandria in Egypt. He had at least 20 different source documents he could use in 1513. This Piri Reis map depicts the Amazon not once, but twice, most probably as a result of the unintentional overlapping of two of the source documents used by the Turkish admiral who produced it. In the first of these, the Amazon's course is shown down to its Para River mouth. But the important island of Marajo does not appear. According to Hapgood, who's more than anyone up to this work with Graham Hancock, had done the research into these ancient maps, according to Hapgood, this suggests that the relevant source map must have dated from a time perhaps as much as 15,000 years ago, 13,000 B.C., when the Para River was the main or only mouth of the Amazon, and when the Marajo Island was part of the mainland on the northern side of the river. The second depiction of the Amazon, on the other hand, does show Marajo, and in fantastically accurate detail, despite the fact that this island was not discovered until 1543, 30 years after the map was drawn. Again, the possibility is raised of an unknown civilization which undertook continuous surveying and mapping operations of the changing face of the earth over a period of many thousands of years, with Piri Reis making use of earlier and later source maps left behind by this civilization. Neither the Orinoco River nor its present delta is represented on the Piri Reis map. Instead, as Hapgood proved, two estuaries extending far inland for a distance of about 100 miles, are shown close to the site of the present river. The longitude on the grid would be correct for the Orinoco, and the latitude is also quite accurate. Is it possible that these estuaries have been filled in and the delta extended this much since the source maps were made? Although they remained undiscovered until 1592, 80 years, roughly, after the map was drawn, the Falkland Islands appear on the 1513 map at their correct latitude. The Library of Ancient Sources incorporated in the Piri Reis map may also account for the fact that it convincingly portrays a large island in the Atlantic Ocean to the east of the South American coast, where no such island now exists. Is it pure coincidence that this imaginary island turns out to be located right over the sub-oceanic mid-Atlantic ridge, just north of the equator and 700 miles east of the coast of Brazil, where the tiny rocks of Saints Peter and Paul now jut above the waves? Or was the relevant source map drawn deep in the last ice age, when sea levels were far lower than they are today, and a large island could indeed have been exposed at this spot? Other 16th century maps also look as though they could have been based on accurate world surveys conducted during the last ice age. One was compiled by the Turk Hagi Ahmed in 1559. A cartographer, as Hapgood puts it, who must have had access to some most extraordinary source maps. The strangest and most immediately striking feature of the Hagi Ahmed's compilation is that it shows quite plainly a strip of territory almost 1,000 miles wide connecting Alaska and Siberia. Such a land bridge, as geologists refer to it, did once exist where the Bering Strait is now, but was submerged beneath the waves by rising sea levels at the end of the last ice age, well beyond 4000 BC. The rising sea levels were caused by the tumultuous melting of the ice cap, which was rapidly retreating everywhere in the northern hemisphere by around 10,000 BC. Likewise, by the breakup of the canopy and the gushing forth waters from the deep as Atlantis sunk. It is therefore interesting that at least one ancient map appears to show southern Sweden covered with remnant glaciers of the kind that must indeed have been prevalent then in these latitudes. The remnant glaciers are on Claudius Ptolemy's famous map of the north. Originally compiled in the 2nd century A.D., this remarkable work from the last great geographer of classical antiquity was lost for hundreds of years and rediscovered in the 15th century. Ptolemy was custodian of the library at Alexandria, which contained the greatest manuscript collection of ancient times, and it was there that he consulted the archaic source documents that enabled him to compile his own map. Acceptance of the possibility that the original version of at least one of the charts he referred to could have been made around 10,000 BC helps us to explain why he shows glaciers, characteristic of that exact epoch, together with lakes, suggesting the shapes of present-day lakes, and streams very much suggesting glacial streams flowing from the glaciers into the lakes. It is probably unnecessary to add that no one on earth in Roman times, when Ptolemy drew his map, had the slightest suspicion that ice ages could once have existed in northern Europe. Nor did anyone in the 15th century, when the map was rediscovered, possess such knowledge. Indeed, it is impossible to see how the remnant glaciers and other features shown on Ptolemy's map could have been surveyed, imagined, or invented by any known civilization prior to our own. The implications of this are obvious. So too are the implications of another map, the Portolano, of Yehudi ibn Ben Zara, drawn in the year 1487. This chart of Europe and North Africa may have been based on a source even earlier than Ptolemy's, for it seems to show glaciers much further south than Sweden, roughly on the same latitude as England, in fact, and to depict the Mediterranean, Adriatic, and Aegean seas as they might have looked before the melting of the European ice cap. Sea level would, of course, have been significantly lower than it is today. It is therefore interesting in the case, for instance, of the Aegean section of the map, to note that a great many more islands are shown than currently exist. At first sight, this seems odd. However, if 10 or 12,000 years have indeed elapsed since the era when Ibn Ben Zara's source map was made, the discrepancy can be simply explained. The missing islands must have been submerged by rising sea levels at the end of the last ice age. We seem to be looking at the fingerprints of a vanished civilization, one capable of drawing impressively accurate maps of widely separated parts of the earth. What kind of technology, and what state of science and culture would have been required to do a job like that? Through all the ancient legends of the people of the Andes stalked a tall, bearded, pale-skinned figure wrapped in a cloak of secrecy. And though he was known by many different names in many different places, he was always recognizable as the same figure, Viracocha, foam of the sea, a master of science and magic who wielded terrible weapons and who came in at a time of chaos to set the world to rights. The same basic story was shared in many variants by all the peoples of the Andean region. It began with a vivid description of a terrifying period when the earth had been inundated by a great flood and plunged into darkness by the disappearance of the sun. Society had fallen into disorder, and the people suffered much hardship. Then, quote, "There appeared suddenly, coming from the south, a white man of large stature and authoritative demeanor. This man had such great power that he changed the hills into valleys, and from the valleys made great hills, causing streams to flow from living stone." End quote. The early Spanish chronicler who recorded this tradition explained that it had been told to him by the Indians as he traveled among them on his journeys in the Andes. He went on to say, quote, "And they heard it from their fathers, who in their turn had it from the old songs which were handed down from very ancient times. They say that this man traveled along the highland route to the north, working marvels as he went, and that they never saw him again. They say that in many places he gave men instructions how they should live, speaking to them with great love and kindness, and admonishing them to be good and to do no damage or injury one to another, but to love one another and show charity to all. In most places they name him Tichy Viracocha." End quote. Other names applied to the same figure throughout the Andes include Huaracocha, Cone, Cone Tichy, or Cone Tiki, Tunapa, Ta'apak, Tupaca, and Ilya. He was a scientist, an architect of surpassing skills, a sculptor, and an engineer. He caused terraces and fields to be formed on the steep sides of ravines, and sustaining walls to rise up and support them. He also made irrigating channels to flow, and he went in various directions arranging many things. End of quote. Viracocha was also a teacher and a healer, and made himself helpful to people in need. It was said, quote, that wherever he passed, he healed all that were sick and restored sight to the blind. End quote. This gentle, civilizing, superhuman Samaritan had another side to his nature, however. If his life were threatened, as it seems to have been on several occasions, he had the weapon of heavenly fire at his disposal. Quote, the Spanish chronicler. Working great miracles by his words, he came to the district of the Canas, and there, near a village called Cacha, the people rose up against him and threatened to stone him. They saw him sink to his knees and raise his hands to heaven as if beseeching aid in the peril which beset him. The Indians declared that thereupon they saw fire in the sky which seemed all around them. Full of fear, they approached him whom they had intended to kill and besought him to forgive them. Presently, they saw that the fire was extinguished at his command, though stones were consumed by fire in such wise that large blocks could be lifted by hand as if they were cork. They narrate further that, leaving the place where this occurred, he came to the coast, and there, holding his mantle, he went forth amidst the waves and was seen no more. And as he went, they gave him the name Viracocha, which means foam of the sea. End quote. The legends were unanimous in their physical description of Viracocha. In his Summa, in Narración de los Incas, for example, Juan de Bastanzos, a 16th century Spanish chronicler, stated that according to the Indians, he had been a bearded man of tall stature, clothed in a white robe which came down to his feet and which he wore belted at the waist. Other descriptions collected from many different and widely separated Andean peoples all seem to identify the same enigmatic individual. According to one, he was, quote, a bearded man of medium height, dressed in rather long cloak. He was past his prime, with gray hair and lean. He walked with a staff and addressed the natives with love, calling them his sons and daughters. As he traversed all the land, he worked miracles. He healed the sick by touch. He spoke every tongue, but even better than the natives. They called him Tunapa, or Tarpaca, Viracocha, Rapacha, or Pacacan. End quote. In one legend, Tunapa, Viracocha, was said to have been a white man of large stature whose air and person aroused great respect and veneration. In another, he was described as a white man of august appearance, blue-eyed, bearded, without headgear, and wearing a kusma, a jerkin or sleeveless shirt, reaching to the knees. And yet another, which seemed to refer to a later phase of his life, he was revered as a wise counselor in matters of state, and depicted as an old man with a beard and long hair, wearing a long tunic. Above all else, Viracocha was remembered in the legend as a teacher. Before his coming, it was said, men lived in a condition of disorder. Many went naked like savages. They had no houses or other dwellings than caves. And from these they went forth to gather whatever they could find to eat in the countryside. Viracocha was credited with changing all this and with initiating the long-lost golden age, which later generations looked back on with nostalgia. All the legends agreed furthermore that he had carried out his civilizing mission. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
These are some of the legends that a few have taken to justify the belief that in the missing 18 years of Jesus' life, he might have appeared in the Andes, as he did at Glastonbury, and as other legends place him in Tibet in those missing years between 12 and 30. But there's more to this body of legends than that. All legends agreed, furthermore, that he had carried out his civilizing mission with great kindness, and because he promised to return from over the sea, this is why they were sitting ducks for the bearded Spanish conquistadores who thought it was the return of the Viracocha. All legends agreed, furthermore, that he carried out his civilizing mission with great kindness and as far as possible had abjured the use of force. Careful instruction and personal example had been the main methods used to equip the people with the techniques and knowledge necessary for a cultured and productive life. In particular, he was remembered for bringing to Peru such varied skills as medicine, metallurgy, farming, animal husbandry, the art of writing, said by the Incas to have been introduced by Viracocha but later forgotten, and a sophisticated understanding of the principles of engineering and architecture. One legend described Viracocha as being accompanied by messengers of two kinds, faithful soldiers, Huamanca, and shining ones, Uipanti. Their role was to carry their Lord's message to every part of the world. Elsewhere, there were phrases such as Contiki returned with a number of attendants. Contiki then summoned his followers, who were called Viracocha. Contiki commanded all but two of the Viracocha to go east. There came from a lake a lord named Contiki Viracocha, bringing with him a certain number of people. Thus, these Viracochas went off to the various districts which Viracocha had indicated for them. The ancient citadel of Sacsayhuaman lies just north of Cuzco. The writer says, we reached it late one afternoon under a sky almost covered by heavy clouds of tarnished silver. A cold gray breeze was blowing across the high altitude tundra as I climbed up stairways through lintel stone gates built for giants and walked along the mammoth rows of zigzag walls. I craned my neck, looked up at a big granite boulder that my route now passed, 12 feet high, 7 feet across, weighing considerably more than 100 tons. It was a work of man, not nature. It had been cut and shaped into a symphonic harmony of angles, manipulated with apparent ease as though made of wax or putty, and... You want me to continue? Just get on the telephone.